afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Team Power. Team Power is our local John Deere and Kubota tractor dealer up in Shasta Lake City. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, and they do everything tractors, parts, sales, service, whatever you need, they can take care of you up there. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or you can get them on the web at readingtractors.com. Bingo.
Bingo.
Yeah, there we are.
Nice.
Yeah.
So,
who's our guest today?
Our guest today is Peter Wallison. We're going to jump right into it because we have two guests today. I guess I should give you that right up front. We're originally airing this show on December 16th in the year 2018. I know we've re-aired shows before in a different year, and people are all mad. We said things about the president, didn't tell them which one.
yeah, like, big difference.
It's like, oopsie, I guess I should start giving a date at the beginning so we don't have any mishaps here. So anyway, it's 2018 at the moment, and our first half is regarding a new book. It's called Judicial Fortitude. Wouldn't we like to have some of that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Peter Wallace.
So it's perfect for Christmas time. All I want for Christmas is some judicial fortitude. And the subtitle is The Last Chance to Rein in the Administrative State. And so I have a feeling this will be a topic that's near and dear to people's hearts. Our guest is the author, Peter Wallison. He is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of the new book, Judicial Fortitude, as I just said. Let's see. He is a frequent media guest. And here he is in our lineup, huh? Which makes us pretty awesome. That's not in the bio.
That's not in the bio.
That was just a little part.
Now you're just winging it.
That was just a little part I added. He's appeared on, major radio. Here we go.
Okay, that's us.
Okay, and television programs, but we have faces for radio, so we'll stay where we are.
Yeah.
Before joining the American Enterprise Institute in 1999, he practiced law as a partner in Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in the firm's Washington and New York offices. He was general counsel of the Treasury Department from 1981 to 85, and he was White House counsel for President Ronald Reagan from 86 to 87. And in the early 70s, he was counsel to Vice President Nelson Rockefeller. So this is like, we're in a whole new realm of information and
that's
also
right.
Outlook.
That's right.
Somebody who comes from the time period where we think things made sense, but I bet he's going to tell us it didn't make sense then either.
Well, I bet it made sense then, but it's gone off the rails.
Yeah, it's
totally
gone berserko now. So he has also authored several other books. I should include that here before we forget. One of the books is Ronald Reagan, The Power of Conviction and the Success of His Presidency. That was in 2003. And Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again. That's 2015. Mm-hmm. So those are all listed on our website that I forgot to mention. So you can find that all at wethepeopleradio.us. Information about our guests, links to previous shows, all of our archives are free of charge to listen to. And we have taken out our celebrations of capitalism, a.k.a. the commercials, for you so that you can actually hear them in less time if you pick them up after our regular Sunday program.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this interview on this book. It sounds super interesting.
God love his publicist. He is a great guy. And I put his contact information on there, Stephen Manfredi. He is with the Manfredi Strategy Group, and he always gives us, sometimes we don't need him, but on a topic like this, he gave us 10 interview questions. It's like, I posted them on the website, because we're not that tricky. So, if you'd like to see what we'll be talking about, that's what we'll be talking about. We have a list. So, I know Mr. Wallison had some things to do. Are you done doing them?
I'm done doing them. I'm sitting quietly in my family's guest room. This is Christmas in New York, and it's crazy generally, but it's pouring rain.
Oh, yeah, here
it's
too.
About 34 degrees.
Yeah, you guys might get a white Christmas. I know it's pouring rain and wet and cold, so who knows?
Oh, it's awful. So I couldn't get a taxi, but I am now, I arrived, and I'm sitting in a very lovely room, and I'm ready to talk.
Cool. All right, well... thanks to Mr. Manfredi, we actually have some things to ask you, not that we really feel compelled to do that, if you just want to go for it.
Yeah, tell us why you wrote this book.
We don't pretend to sound smart about things we know nothing about.
Well, I'm happy to do it without the questions.
All right.
Just start off talking, and if you have some questions about what I say, that would be fine. It'd be great.
Cool. Well,
first of all, just to talk about what the administrative state is, and in some interviews, I have people who say, "Well, what is this administrative state?" And the answer is that it is the federal government's agencies, from the very important ones, the very large ones like the Treasury Department or HHS, Department of Education, all the way down to, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them, all the way down to the independent agencies like the SEC or the FCC. These are very powerful organizations, and they have become much more powerful over the last 25 or 30 years. And the real problem for me, and the reason I wrote the book, is that to me they represent a threat to democracy, because they have so much power and they are able to make so many rules that, in fact, they seem to be supplanting the Congress in terms of making laws for the American people.
Yeah, now, I think people have seen that going on for a long time now. It's like our Congress doesn't make laws anymore. The judiciary does.
They make laws, but then all of a sudden these guys make all the, like EPA is a great example, especially for out here where we are. EPA goes wild. And then Congress has to pass a law to make them not go wild, but that's really hard to do. It takes a long time.
It is very hard. That's right. It's very hard to do. And in fact, it's impossible for either Congress or the president to rein in the administrative state themselves, rein in all these agencies.
Which is scary since the president's in charge of them. Oops.
Right, exactly. And that's a very odd situation. But when I tell you why it's like this, you'll see. And that is that for the last 25 years, in every year, more than 3,000 rules and regulations have come out of these agencies. 3,000 rules and regulations
each
year, for a total of about 101,000 regulations that are now on the American people to obey. But, of course, the American people can have no idea what these regulations are requiring them to do. And because there are so many, Congress can't really step in and review each of them. The president doesn't have the time. His staff doesn't have the time to review every one of them. So they just keep pouring out. And the question is, how can we stop that from happening? There are three parts of our government, as you know. There is a Congress that is supposed to make the laws. This is a democracy. We elect our representatives. They are supposed to make the laws. There is the executive branch headed by the president, and they're supposed to enforce the laws. But that's all. Just enforce the laws that Congress makes, not go beyond that. And then there is the judiciary, and they are supposed to interpret the laws. And unfortunately, what has been happening is that Congress, over many years, has begun to hand over to these administrative agencies a lot of power. You were talking before about the EPA. EPA is a perfect example of that. When Congress was making rules about clean water, instead of deciding themselves how far the rules were supposed to go and who was actually supposed to be covered, they handed that all over to the EPA. So it turns out that the real rules, the real laws, are being made by these unelected people in Washington, D.C., and not by the people who are representing the American people.
And, right. And I'll give you an example that we had here in our local area, because we have so much agriculture here. So the Army Corps of Engineers is regularly, people may have followed the Duarte case. I think the guy's in almost $3 million in fines now. And basically planting a crop, he created little furrows, which, of course, became waters of the U.S. because his rain fell in a little depression in the ground. Okay, so it got super, super crazy. So the congressman here in the 1st District actually put in it became law, actually. It was one sentence. People complain all the time, oh, all these bills are too big. This was a little attachment, amendment that said that the EPA is not allowed to regulate farming. I mean, It was under 20 words. And that was signed into law. That's fairly straightforward. So all this silliness kept continuing here. So the local congressional office has a meeting with the EPA guy or the Army Corps of Engineer guys, and they said, "Well, here's this new law. You know, Army Corps of Engineers is no longer allowed to regulate farming. So what are you guys doing?" You know what their answer was? "We don't read it that way."
Yeah, sure.
We don't read it that way. It's like, yeah, it doesn't
and that
matter
stops
how
them in their tracks that, right there.
It doesn't matter how simple that, you make it. You can't get there from here.
This is such a perfect example of the book.
Yeah.
Because it's called Judicial Fortitude. And what it's titled that because it's important that the courts have the fortitude to stand up to the elected branches. And the courts now are the only ones who can stop the growth and the power of the administrative state. And that is, someone has to take this case to court, the one you're talking about whether they can regulate farming, and the courts would then decide whether what was intended by Congress was to allow EPA to read it the way they want or the way Congress intended that law to be read. That's why it is so important that the courts get much more involved in looking at what these laws provide, what kind of powers they give to the administrative state, and to cut back on what the administrative agencies are doing by interpreting the laws the way Congress intended the law to be interpreted.
Yeah, not the crazy town environmental way. Which part of not allowed to regulate farming was confusing? We have to take a really, really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest. I can already tell we are not going to have enough time, but we will do our best, and we cut back on the music today, so you'll be happy for that. We'll get right back to him. Our guest is Peter Wallison, the author of Judicial Fortitude. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. All right, Mr. Wallison. We were talking in the break that the idea of the judiciary becoming more having a heavier hand probably freaks out some people because they're thinking, "Oh my gosh, no, they're already doing it." But I think what we're seeing now, at least out here in the West, is that the courts are actually making their own laws too. So you have the administrative state making up stuff, the courts are making up stuff, and then they back up the administrative guys, and it's like a 2-to-1 game.
Right. Classic examples: the Ninth Circuit, when they do pass a law, Ninth Circuit steps in and says, "Oh no, you can't do that." And
you're not allowed to swear on the radio. You just said Ninth Circuit.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah. So I totally understand what you're saying, but how do we combat that?
Well, we have to look at the Supreme Court. There is only one decider, and that is the Supreme Court. And today, we have a majority of the court, unlike all the time I've been practicing law or have been observing what the courts do. This is the first time we've had a majority of conservatives.
And the Kavanaugh confirmation was
exactly.
The kind of game changer, right?
That's right. That made the difference. And so now we have five people on the court who have said over time and various times during their careers, some of them already on the court, like Justice Thomas, who I dedicated the book to, others who were judges in the appellate system, and that would be Gorsuch, who was appointed by Trump, and also Kavanaugh, appointed by Trump. All of those people have at one time or another said that they believe that they have to cut back on the threats to the separation of powers. And what they mean by that is that what the framers decided when they wrote the Constitution is that the laws would only be made by Congress and the executive branch would only enforce the laws. They wouldn't make laws. And so what that means to them And as cases come up through the system to them, they will start cutting back on the authority of the administrative agencies. Just this past week, the Supreme Court, I'm sure you haven't heard about this because almost no one covered this, but just in the past week, the Supreme Court took a case in which the Veterans Administration was claiming to change some of its regulations in a way that made it difficult for a veteran to receive compensation for his PTSD. And the court took that case because there has been, for the last 85 years, an idea in the courts that they had to defer, that is to accept, whatever the agencies said their regulations meant. The court now has taken this case. They wouldn't have taken this case if they were going to just reaffirm something they've been doing for 85 years.
Right.
So they are going to make a new rule here, which will probably be that the courts no longer have to defer to agencies' changes in their own regulations. And when you think about it, that's really important for the rule of law in this country, because to the extent that people even read regulations, they're told, they know by reading the regulation what they're required to do. But if the agency can just change the regulation at any time it wants, then people really have no way of knowing how they're supposed to structure their businesses or their personal activities and so forth. So if the court actually goes as far as to take away that what is called deference for the agencies, that will be a big step in toward a much better rule of law in the United States. The next thing that has to be done is to deal with a case called Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council.
No.
And that case, which was decided in 1984, provides for deference to agencies' interpretation of their own powers.
Yeah.
It goes even further.
How could that go wrong?
Right. What could happen then?
Yeah, how could that be bad?
So, right. And so I think the court is going to pick that one up, too, because all of those guys said at one time or another that the Chevron case has made things get out of control. And that's why we have 3,000 regulations every year, more than 3,000 every year, and over 100,000 in the last 25 years because of this Chevron case. So I think the court will take that up, and I think they will cut back on deference there. Now, this is where judicial fortitude comes in, because the blowback will be enormous when the court tries to do this. There will be huge opposition from the left. And what they're going to say is, oh, the court is taking away all our protections that we've had since the New Deal, all that stuff.
All our free money since the Equal Access to Justice Act was passed.
Yeah, all those things. But the point is this a democracy or is it not? And that's what we conservatives have to talk about. Are the people making the rules, or are a group of unelected folks living around Washington, D.C., making the rules? And so this is the point of the book, and that's why I wrote the book, so that people will have an opportunity to see that there is a way of cutting back on something like the administrative state, which is actually taking away, gradually, year after year, taking away more and more of our democracy.
So if the court rules to change that, every single rule on these agencies doesn't have to be relitigated, does it? I mean, it should be kind of a blanket.
If somebody calls them on it, though, they don't automatically get a pass, because that's what's happening now.
Right, they just get a pass. But if the Supreme Court changes their view on that, then, we have thousands of these regulations. They don't all have to go back to the Supreme Court at that point.
That's a really good question, and what will happen here is that the agencies will stop issuing so many regulations, because they will be aware then that every new regulation that comes out can be challenged by private citizens under what the court is, I hope, going to say eventually, and that is the courts no longer have to pay deference to what the agencies think their power is. The courts will decide what the agency's power is, and so that will immediately make it very difficult for the agencies to establish new rules that weren't actually intended by Congress. Then you have a further problem going back into history, because there are an awful lot of rules that are already out there, and those will have to be dealt with over time. But the fact is that once the agencies recognize that they can be challenged, and the courts are willing to do that, then they're going to stop making new regulations and enforcing old regulations where they are no longer sure that they really have the authority from Congress to make those rules.
Sure, because every time someone is confronted by an agency that says, you must do X, Y, and Z, the first question that the citizen should ask is, I want to see the regulation, and I want to see the laws that allow that regulation to be put in place. Those two things should tie in sequence, direct sequence. Here's the law that says you can't do blah, blah, blah. And so we've actually put it in the on-the-ground wording that says this, which is the regulation. Those two things should be exactly the same. And right now there's a huge disconnect.
Exactly. And we can change that. And the courts can change that. But you do need a majority at the Supreme Court to do it. And that majority has to, they have to be guys who... men and women who are willing to take the criticism that they are going to get in the media for doing this. And I think we have such people now, but they will have to be in that court for years and years.
Yeah, because the left is somehow just in love with bureaucracy. They bigger government, more bureaucrats, more... It's just it's crazy to me. We have to take another really quick break and celebrate a little capitalism here. And we'll be back with our guest, Peter J. Wallison, who has authored a book called Judicial Fortitude. I think you'll like it. You can find everything about the program and our guest at wethepeopleradio.us.
Peter, one of the things that the Trump administration has done that's gone largely unnoticed is he has appointed a lot of judges, and it's been kind of a quiet thing. I mean, he's got a long way to go, but what do you think the impact of that's going to be?
Well, it's exactly what I was hoping it would be, and that is that these are all people who are conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And that will mean that they are going to be reading the law and making sure that the agencies do not go beyond what authority Congress actually gave them. It may not make a lot of news where you are, but it's making a lot of news in Washington. And one of the things that the Senate has been trying to do all this time is to get these judges confirmed. In large numbers, they will have 12 or 13 of them, district judges and appellate court judges, up for confirmation at a time.
Right.
And it's very hard to do because filibusters are not permitted anymore on appointments, but you do get 30 hours of debate on each appointment in the Senate. So the Democrats have been trying over time to delay things as much as possible, but the Senate Majority Leader... has been very strong on getting these people up before the Senate and taking the time to make sure they get a vote and are confirmed for these judgeships because these are very, very important.
Do you think the media, because like you're saying, out here you hear very little about these appointments. Do you think the media really recognizes the importance of this? I mean, they're busy chasing Russia and Donald Trump's parking violations. In the meantime, he's quietly, appointing judges. I think they're, I don't know, from what I see, they're largely overlooking the importance of what's going on there.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the reason they are overlooking it is they know it. There's been lots of commentary in the media about how important this is. But in terms of news stories, it's not much of a news story.
Right.
That a person who nobody knows has now been appointed to a court position that nobody understands.
Right.
It just it's not something that really grabs your attention.
Exactly.
There's a headline about it. But he has put in, I don't know what the number is now, but he's well past what Obama was doing in his 8 years, and Trump has done it in two. So it is continuing along that path, and as long as the Senate remains in Republican hands, Trump has two more years to continue to funnel these conservatives into the court system, and that means that every time a case comes up, there will likely be a conservative view, if not a conservative majority, on the court that is looking at the.
What's the term for these judges?
Lifetime.
Okay.
Lifetime. And that's really important to know because that, in the book, again, let me go back to the book for a moment. This is called Judicial Fortitude. I use that term because Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the framers of the Constitution, wrote a piece at the time that the framers were trying to persuade the American people to adopt this Constitution. And he was asked, well, why is it in a democratic society that we have these judges who are appointed for life, and that's in the Constitution. And Alexander Hamilton answered it this way. He said, well, the purpose of the courts is to make sure that the Constitution that we have established remains in effect, even if the elected branches, that is the President and Congress, try to modify it in some way. Because we believe that the Constitution preserves people's liberties, and that's what this whole thing has been about. And so, what the reason we gave all these court the judges lifetime appointments is so they will have the fortitude to stand up to the elected branches,
right.
Because they
not
don't have a re-election situation going
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
It's no longer a popularity contest over there.
It's really an important point. And the trouble is, however, if I can go on just a little bit about this, in 1935, the court did try to turn down a number of things that Franklin Roosevelt had proposed and the Congress had adopted as unconstitutional. And in 1936, Roosevelt had a landslide re-election, and at that time he proposed what was called the court packing plan, which would have put seven new justices on the Supreme Court to make it a court of 16, but would have given his point of view a majority on that court.
Right.
So that frightened the Supreme Court. And they backed away from a lot of the positions they had been taking, that some of the things that Roosevelt had proposed were unconstitutional. They backed away. Even though the court packing plan was not adopted, I think the Supreme Court recognized that they couldn't go too far here without getting into trouble. Now we're in almost the same exact position in that we have a Supreme Court that would be willing to turn down some of these things that the agencies are doing, but there will be a lot of opposition, a lot of blowback on this activity, and it's necessary under those circumstances for conservatives throughout this country instead of fighting about one another, with one another, to go out and say, look, this is important. This is our democracy. We have to be able to make sure that the rules are made by the people we elect and not by this unelected group. So this, we're coming to the same point again in our history where we were in 1935. In 1935, the court got frightened away from continuing on the course it was on, and we're now in a place where the court could again be frightened away, even though these guys are conservatives. If the blowback is so tough and difficult for them to preserve the reputation of the court or to preserve the idea that the court will continue to make rules that are at least somewhat conservative, they might have to back away from the things that really have to be done. And that's why all conservatives should be out there making sure that the court knows that they will have support if they go forward with reining in the administrative state.
Yeah, see, because in I think a lot of our citizenry fundamentally misunderstands how a representative republic actually works. Because when they see, they want the Supreme Court to decide things the way they see them or what they view the public sentiment is, which isn't their job. You know, when people were saying if Kavanaugh gets on the court, they'll be able to keep Donald Trump in the presidency forever. It's like, okay, all right, well that's. That's probably more than a fundamental misunderstanding there. That's about as kind as I get. And then you swing back over to the legislative branch, and people want their member of Congress or their senator, whichever, and fire the bureaucrats in the executive branch. You know, why can't you just go tell them, you know, not to demolish our dam? You should go tell the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that they have to leave it there. It's like, well, that would, or the president. They want the president to go tell them that, too. It's like, okay, in a monarchy, that would be terrific. But that's not, again, what we have. So then people start grasping, and I'm sure you hear all this stuff, too, and just rip your hair out. Then you start hearing, well, we need term limits now. Let's put term limits on the people making the laws because the people who are regulating us are doing a bad job. It's like, oh, wait a minute.
Don't we have elections?
That's actually not how that works.
Yeah,
we have term limits. We call them elections. But, yeah, I don't know. Glad I got that all out.
It's just bugs me. Right. I mean, people do get a little desperate.
But they start blaming the wrong. Yeah, they blame the wrong entity.
Right.
You know, they're looking for the fix in the wrong place.
Yeah, and they're looking at a very quick fix, too, which is always very hard.
Well, then there's that.
This is a long game. It's a very, very long game. And we have one of the things that Trump has been doing, and that is appointing young judges. That was very important. When I was in the Reagan administration, we were doing the same. We were finding people who were in their early 40s who would serve a long time on the court and on the courts. And the reason was that we were hoping that these good conservatives would have their influence would be felt over a long period of time. And that's true now on the Supreme Court, with the exception of Justice Thomas, who's probably 70 years old. All the rest of them are young men.
Yeah. Well, you look at what has happened. You know, I'm sure it was crushing to watch, you know, Clinton roll in and unravel so much stuff and give so much power to the bureaucrats, especially in the environmental arena, just mushroomed their control and their ability to really make their own rules.
Right. And, this is something that can be fixed, and that's why I wrote the book, because it's so important that we understand what the stakes are here and how this can actually be accomplished. And that's why it says this is the last chance to rein in the administrative state, because if we don't do it through the court system, we'll never be able to do it.
Yeah, that's true. And so once they, I guess I'm trying to think like, okay, so let's say this passes. Let's kind of fast forward into the direction that we could see it going. Okay, so the Supreme Court takes this up and says, okay, bureaucrats, you guys aren't allowed to make up regulations that suit you. Everything has to be tied to a law that was passed by the representatives of the people. Period. Are people going to have to... It's kind of what Bill asked earlier. You know, how much of it will go away? I mean, what do you think? Do you think they'll fix some of this themselves, or we can just have to sue them from now until hell freezes over so that we can?
I think a lot of it will be fixed just by what the court has said in one case. A lot of it will be fixed.
Yeah, that's
every agency has lawyers.
That's true.
None of them want to be in court defending something that is going to be overturned. So they will tell their officials, their bosses, so to speak, look, if you go forward with this, this is a very dicey interpretation. And I think that if you're taken to court by someone who is regulated by this rule you're proposing, you're going to lose. And so many of the officials will then pull back, and they won't try to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That stops the ones that could come out, that won't come out because of what the Supreme Court has done. We still have a whole lot that are there already and have been interpreted in certain ways by the agencies, and those have to be attacked too. But I do believe that the agencies, as they watch the process, as they see that the courts are being very restrictive in what they allow the agencies to do, they will stop trying to use laws that were passed 30, 40, or 50 years ago to make new regulations, because they will realize that it's very hard to get a court to believe that Congress intended something to be done now in the economy we have today that Congress could not even have conceived of when they adopted, say, the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1932.
See, that's a, you know, and it's interesting. All of us that are chatting with each other, it's a good thing we're all old, because we remember when winning was winning and losing was losing. Now everybody gets a trophy. But in this circumstance, the concept of winning and losing comes right home. So it is a good thing that there are winners and losers. Well, it's always been a good thing, but maybe this will help people figure that out. We've got to take one last quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Peter J. Wallison. He is the author of Judicial Fortitude. Sounds like an awesome read. We have not had a chance to do that yet. You're listening to We the People. You can find everything about this show at wethepeopleradio.us. Bureaucrat theme song.
There you go. Peter, one of the
you can if your book ever becomes a musical, you could use that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it becomes a musical. I'm in great shape.
Hey, Peter. One of the things we were talking about at the break was in the past, traditionally, I guess, when it comes time to appoint a judge, the president usually takes the recommendation of the sitting Senate or senator or whatever from that particular district takes their recommendation for the appointment. Is that the case with Trump now? Is he kind of breaking from that and making his own, or is he still accepting the recommendations? I know in the Ninth Circuit, I think he made a comment about he wasn't going to require or didn't really need a recommendation from Feinstein or the rest of them. He had his own folks. Is that the case?
Yes, that's right. He has been using something called the Federalist Society, which is a group of young, well, they were young once. These are lawyers. Many of them were Supreme Court clerks and clerks for other courts and judges. He has been using them to make recommendations for good judges in the not only the Supreme Court, but in the appellate courts and
right.
in some cases the district courts, too. So he's not relying on the local senator to make these recommendations, although if the senator who is a friend of Trump's or someone who is a supporter of Trump's and makes a recommendation of someone who falls into the category of young, intelligent, vigorous, and conservative, I think Trump
yeah,
would not
that'd probably be a good pick. Right, and I imagine that is probably upsetting the status quo in D.C.
How dare
it's
he?
It's kind of taking their power away a little bit, because that's a big deal.
Oh, a huge deal.
Yeah.
And it is a little bit under the kinds of news that most people get, but in D.C. it is a big deal that all these people are getting these very, very important, powerful judgeships.
Mm-hmm. That's a good thing.
How dare he take recommendations from someone else that isn't, nailed down to the beltway? Stunning the kinds of things they complain about.
Also, things in the Senate that have made it difficult, too, and that is the Senate has always had these informal agreements among themselves. And so if someone is appointed from your state and you don't like that person, you can stop it. That has basically been pushed aside by the Republicans in the Senate now. So if a Democrat doesn't like the fact that they doesn't like a particular person who's been nominated from his or her state, they say, well, okay, we appreciate that, but we're going forward with this anyway. I mean, it's because it is so important that they understand in the Senate how important this really is, even though it doesn't make a lot of news around the country.
Right, right. And I think that's the part that I think people are missing. So
how quickly do you think these cases will be heard? How does that work? What's kind of the...
Well, it is slow. The judicial system works slowly, but the great advantage of it is that once the Supreme Court has made a decision, all the courts fall into place. And that's good and bad. For example, in the so-called Chevron decision that I talked about before, with deference to agency's interpretation of the laws, when the Supreme Court made that decision, then immediately all the courts in the country started to give deference to administrative agencies. And now if the court turns around the Chevron case, which many people and I think they will eventually do, then that will turn on a dime everything that happens in the court system. So it's really a unique way of dealing with this problem. Even if you had majorities in Congress, you wouldn't be able to get these things controlled as easily as you can if you have the right kind of court system.
Right, because you pass the law, the bureaucrats make kooky regulations and basically disregard the law, and the court says, oh, but that's okay, they can do that. So you're back to square one, but you already made the law. So what are you going to do, make another one? No, this one, you really, for real.
Yeah, it's very hard to do. So that's why the court system would work very well once they take it upon themselves to read carefully what the agents, what the Congress has done, and to say, I ruled this is outside what Congress
right.
did. And the book has many examples of this. So a reader will be able to understand then how the system got out of control and why it would be pretty easy for the courts to bring it back into control.
Now, when the courts pick a case to hear, I mean, obviously they don't hear very many cases in a year, what, 12, 15 cases a year. Do they pick cases that will have the biggest impact or the most influence over pending cases they have to hear? In other words, to take a lot off the docket at one time with one ruling. Is that?
Yeah. Well, both. I mean, actually, the Supreme Court will take about 60 cases a year.
Oh, okay.
And some of them they take because the circuits, the circuit courts, the 9th, the 5th, the 6th, and so forth, the circuit courts are in disagreement. Mm-hmm. They have come up with different interpretations of the same law.
Right.
So the Supreme Court will take that case to settle that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no longer a disagreement among the circuits. They will also take a case where they want to make some important decision. And that's the one I was talking about earlier, the one that they did the beginning of last week. It's called the Kisor case, K-I-S-O-R. That case involved just a single guy who was unable to get coverage for medical care from the Veterans Administration because of an interpretation they made of their own regulations. This is a very, very small matter in terms of, it's big for him, mm-hmm. but it's small in terms of the entire, get the Supreme Court reached out, took that case, and said they were going to decide this. And I think we know what they're going to decide because they wouldn't have taken the case unless they were going to overrule this deference, because they've been doing it for 85 years, and it mm-hmm. doesn't make any sense for them to take this case and just say, oh, well, we've been right for 85 years. No, they're going to overturn that deference case. And that's an example of another way that the court influences the way the government operates.
I think that's fantastic, because honestly, we have gone so far afield from, you know, where we should be. VA is a great example, and honestly, one of the things I think so many people, especially in the rural parts of our country, which is the vast majority of the geography of our country, is rural, and you look at the crushing interference with all these agencies that have just been loaded up with environmental activists, really. And so, you know, they just regulate the way they see the world, and then, bing, they get to be in charge.
Yep.
It's a travesty.
Right. And you don't even have to be elected.
No, no. And so then they look at the elected people, and they're like, what do we care about you? Yeah.
That's terrible.
Right.
Peter, thank you for coming on. This has been an enlightening conversation, and I'm definitely going to get this book because it's a big deal. It's a big deal right now.
This is kind of a Christmas present for everybody because, you know, for all those people that are wishing that the agencies get their wings clipped.
Yep, it's coming.
It sounds like it's coming. God, that's fantastic.
One thing I might say is that it's probably difficult to find it in a bookstore, so the best thing to do is to go to Amazon, which has them.
Okay.
And sells them at a discount, which is something people will like too. But if you go to your local bookstore, the chances are they don't have the book.
Just not. They're just not tuning in on the important stuff.
Yes,
what the heck is up with that?
Exactly.
So the book is Judicial Fortitude. The author is Peter Wallison, Wallison. And I will put all those links on the website for you. Peter, thanks a million.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed this talk.
All right. Have a Merry Christmas. We'll be back for our second hour where we're going to talk about Merry Christmas with our guest, Bruce Moran. You're listening to We the People.